Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are issuing a rallying cry in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Well then, we went to Rome full of hope and came back with a mountain to climb as Roma put us to the sword, and we go into Thursday's second leg with a 4-goal deficit. Let's be honest, the chances of us getting out of this tie alive are slim to none, but stranger things have happened. Hashtag keep the faith. Of course, there was another game sandwiched between these two Roma ties, and it saw us just about get over the line, beating Forest 1-0 with a most undeserby-like performance at a very flat Amex. Let's hope then that we can lift the atmosphere on Thursday night if it were to give ourselves any chance of getting through. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wes, and we are delighted to welcome back a true gladiator of Rome. It's Jason Thackeray. Hello, Jay. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, AD. Hi, Al. Yeah, all good, mate. Good love to see you chaps again.
How are you feeling? Because I'm still exhausted.
Notwithstanding the lack of 90 minutes of, you know, a good away day sport, how's Rome for you?
You just said he's still. I'm absolutely shattered still. It had highs and lows, it's fair to say, Al. The major low being in the game, obviously, in the ground. But we spent 2 days travelling to get there. I spent sort of 13 hours just to get to Roma Termini, and then another 40 minutes in a taxi queue on Wednesday. So
what was your route then?
We flew to Milan Malpensa, right. And it's an hour from there to Milan Centrale on the so-called Milan Express train. waited for Jamie at Milan Centrale, my mate Jamie, whose flight was cancelled, so we missed two trains for no real reason. 3-hour train journey down to Rome, 40 minutes in a taxi queue, an hour waiting to get a pizza in a tourist restaurant, and then I went to bed. That was my Wednesday.
How efficient are the Italians then? What was your travel mare? Because I recall reading a few of your messages saying that you're having a bit of a pain in the backside trying to get to Rome, AD.
Yeah, it wasn't much fun. I mean, basically, I mean, I know that from reading other people's reports of this, it was very much like an episode of Race Across the World. But it was, I mean, I did 5 airports on my journey. So basically, and I got the bus from here in Worthing to Heathrow early on Wednesday morning at 4 o'clock on Wednesday morning. And I was looking out the window on the bus and I could see this fog getting thicker and thicker and thicker. And I thought, this isn't going to end well. And I got to Heathrow. Everything was still on time. And then my flight got delayed by 2 hours, which basically meant I missed the connection at Zurich. So I ended up having to spend 5 hours in Zurich airport. Can you believe you cannot get any Swiss cheese in Zurich airport? Trust me, I tried.
Why would you try and get Swiss cheese? I mean, I know you're in Switzerland, so that's how you would do it. But of all places you're going to get Swiss cheese, the airport would be the last place, really, I'd think of.
Well, no, yeah, they normally have those little food sections in the duty-free shops, don't they?
It's like, okay, so you went from Worthing to Heathrow to Zurich, and in each case, staying there for ages.
I eventually flew from Zurich to Rome. I was meant to get in at 2 o'clock, got in about 9, and then I met our good sponsor, Mr. Phil Shelley, and wife, and of course Vicky of This Paris, and Kieran Maguire, Andy Bass. It was a roar outing. It was
So you'd have been better off walking, wouldn't you?
A skateboard or a pogo stick.
I think that there were as many different routes to get to Rome as there were people that went. We had Monica, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago. She went via Bristol. I know that there was another alternative of flying via Nice and then to Rome. I know that Attila took the train all the way from London all the way down to Rome itself. And this doesn't even begin to start the route home as well, because I noticed a few people were staying in Florence for a couple of days mm-hmm. afterwards, which is another beautiful city. But like I say, it just seems like, you know, a really sort of romantic week out for so many Brighton fans, absolutely obliterated by 90 minutes of football.
Yeah, I mean, well, we'll get into the game in a minute. But I mean, you know, it's such a lovely place. It's so surreal when you're in this beautiful, ornate Roman city. Well, literally Roman city, and like, you know, you're looking at the Trevor Brooking fountain and the.
Did you come up with that yourself?
I cannot claim that myself, no. But,
all right, okay.
And, you know, and you go into the Colosseum and you sing all the, and you're just walking around. You walk, turn around the corner. Oh, hello, mate. How are you? And you turn another corner. Hey, Jamie, how are you? It's like it was just walking around Brighton on a match day. It was just surreal. Just
Jason,
so
that
surreal.
must have been a thing for you then as well.
Yeah, I absolutely. It was the Thursday was great. I mean, took Owen on a walking trip all the way through, my son Owen, on a walking trip all the way through Rome. We started up, sort of walked to the Colosseum and then walked all the way back to where the coaches pick you up by the Spanish Steps and the Trevi Fountain and a pizza for lunch, and just saw loads of faces we knew, got in the ground. The seats that we picked, because they were unallocated, were quite close to the entrance, so people were coming past as they were coming in, and they're all the people that I've known for years and years following the Albion. So it was, in terms of seeing some friendly faces miles from home, that was a great element to it, I think.
Yeah, it's not quite the same as having a holiday, is it?
No.
unfortunately, we do have to touch on some people who did encounter some not so friendly faces, Jay. And I was getting messages from home, like asking if you're okay, which is lovely to that people cared. But it was not a great trip for those guys, was it?
No, it really wasn't. And I know a few of them, so I've done quite a few aways this season. And Jack Albion, as he's known.
We
to
all him. Know Jack.
Everyone knows Jack at the game, but we met Jack about a year ago because he was based in Port Slade then, and I'm based in Port Slade. Enough to say that when I went to Amsterdam, it was Jack and his mates that me and my son met in an Irish pub near De Vollen. And we had a big night out with them on the Wednesday night, and they were obviously doing exactly the same thing in Rome. And the guys got attacked walking home.
Now, without sort of like going too much into detail, let's look at the sort of like the aftermath. Now, obviously, the both guys thankfully made it to the game, and mm-hmm. they made it to the Amex on the Sunday, where I think the crutches were a little bit of a landmark as to where Jack sits. But
and the
yellow coat. But there was the thing where obviously where the Albion fans, and this is where the Albion fans really do come into their own. Rallying round and chucking in a few quid to make sure that no one was out of pocket. So can you just give us a quick sort of admin update onto what's happening there?
Yeah, no, I definitely can. So I was talking to Jack on WhatsApp from sort of first thing Thursday morning when I found out what had happened to him, and just checking he was okay. And one of the things he said is, I've no idea how much this is going to cost, ha ha ha. And at the end of the day, your medical expenses are normally covered by EHIC or GHIC, so that wasn't an issue. But the guys had lost, particularly Andy, who I believe went back and actually helped them out, had lost some money and some possessions, and also had sort of 100 quid out of pocket for an emergency passport. And a couple of people had said on the thread about Jack on North Stand chat, oh, we should just set something up to make sure they're not out of pocket, but no one had actually done it. So I messaged Jack on Saturday night and said, are you out of pocket? And he went, no, we're fine. We're all covered on insurance. So I went, oh, that's great. And went to bed. And then he rang me the next day and went, actually, I'm fine, but Andy isn't. He's had cash taken. He's had AirPods taken. He's out of pocket for a passport. And I messaged Darren McKay, who runs North Sandchow, and went, look, can we just stick something up just to get Andy covered? And I expected people would stick in, you know, 2 quid here, 5 quid there. Darren not only let me do it, but he put it on the North Stand chat Twitter, and before we knew it, we raised £1,000. We were like, ah, Andy's only lost about 300.
So what's happened to the balance?
So the balance, if you look on, there's a thread about it on North Stand chat where Jack's relatives had emailed a restaurant who helped the guys out, sort of, you know, treated them, called the medical services and the police and all of that sort of thing. And they'd written to say thank you, and they got a lovely letter back. And one of the things the guy said is, you know, I'm a Brighton fan now too. He was very kind of magnanimous about it. So we want to get them A Brighton related gift. And then Darren, as I talk, is on the hunt for a knife crime prevention charity, either here or in Italy, that we can give the balance to. And once we do that, because obviously we shut off the fundraiser that was going directly to Andy, we'll reopen it, but with the different direction so that it goes to that charity.
I was about to say,
we're going to send him a box of Piglet's pies, aren't we?
Yeah, to a restaurant. Yeah, how's that going to go down?
I've seen the restaurant's menu. No, we're not.
But I just want to say that from that final admin point of view, because I didn't see this thing come up on social media until it was too late, until I'd seen that the fundraising had closed down. But when I saw the three main areas that it was going to, one was obviously making sure Andy wasn't out of pocket, two, the prize for the restaurant, but the three, and I think this is probably the wider scope of it, is a charity for victims of knife crime. Now, I think just before we came on air here, we were just talking about there's tax reasons and there's this and there's that, that you can't spread the money around. You've got to do one thing with it. So with this in mind, is there going to be are you going to look at reopening or restarting a new one with this in mind about donating to a knife crime charity?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. So just to be completely transparent, when you set up a GoFundMe account, it asks you to choose the beneficiary as either a person or a charity. It can't be both. So we wanted the money to go initially to Andy so that he was immediately not out of pocket. He's transferring anything over the top to Darren, who's going to sort out the restaurant and the charity. Then obviously what I can do is set up a second account where people can directly via GoFundMe or via a direct link give money to that charity. And we'll cross that bridge once Darren's found exactly who that money's going to. But it will be a knife crime-based charity.
Okay, well, watch this space on social media, and we'll obviously relay the details and to donate to as and when this comes up.
Well, let's. I mean, obviously, it's very important that we do this, and it is brilliant.
And we wish Jack and Andy a speedy recovery.
We do, and I mean, I still think it was cruel of the club to make him go up the stairs to West Upper on. He was in front of me. I mean, he was.
Was he in
a
lift?
No, of course he didn't use the lift. He's a hero.
Oh yes, good point. Well made.
Okay, well, let's get into the nuts and bolts of the game itself, then. I mean, getting into the stadium, I mean, obviously, it was impressive, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I was on one of the first buses in because we'd finished our sort of walking tour and lunch around Villa Gates. We got up there about 2:30, ready to get the first buses, which were supposed to leave at 3:00. I don't think they left till 3:30 in the end. But I think we were on the third or fourth bus in. So once we'd had our ticket checked 8 times, been searched 8 times, all of that sort of repetitive security that you had to go through. And you walked in and you just went, wow, this is huge. Because
it's a massive arena, yeah.
Massive. I got a photo of it almost empty and I got a photo of it full and a video of it full. And it is just an incredible size. And the fact that it's a bowl, it is gladiatorial. Obviously, it's an Olympic stadium, that's its name, but it is very fitting for the city that it's in.
Yeah, but, you know, it was just the noise that they were making, and they were roundly booing Sussex by the Sea, which was, there's hardly anyone there. I'm like, who's booing this? There's nobody here. And there's only Brighton fans here. But, I mean, you know, that Roma Roma song as well, which is very Eurovision, isn't it? It's in fact, I think there are certain things. They look like they're massive fans of Eurovision because you know that thing where they're announcing and they have to go through the arch, and then this was just coming out from the warm up, and like it was hilarious.
Different cultures.
I just wonder if there should be like an alternative Eurovision, which is a football Eurovision with like the music that they play before games, because Amsterdam was kind of accordion techno.
It was
kind of like, just imagine like traditional Dutch music but with a 150 beat per minute gabba beat on the back of it.
I can imagine it.
I got lost in the Amsterdam arena, and it was hard house absolutely everywhere. It was hilarious.
If I rewind about 20 years ago to Portugal to Euro 2004, well, one, they weren't so much into their techno, but they did seem to be massively into The Cure. You had The Cure playing all the time. But when the techno did start up, I remember sitting in amongst a bunch of Germans in a matchup between the Germany and the Netherlands, and they loved a good dance along to their Europop techno stuff, which incidentally we're not finishing today's show with, because there'll be a little bit. No, there'll be a lot of ick coming up from me.
So I'll be saying that the Forest game was just one of those in between days.
Not bad, not bad.
Okay, well, I mean, Jason, I mean, I said before the game that the tie couldn't be won tonight, but could be lost. I'm actually going into the game on Thursday full of confidence. Actually, I think we're going to do it. But it is
Right, hang on, Jason. Before you answer, AD, I want you to actually justify this confidence. Unless you've been drinking liquid optimism, what on earth is going on in your head?
I've just got this feeling today. I don't know why. I think we scored four goals quite a lot under De Zerbi. It's just a case of keeping the back door shut. That's the problem. Let's face it. Going into the game on in Rome, I think we'd all have been a lot more confident if we had João Pedro, if we had Kaoru Mitoma, if we had Solly March, any one of our injured like game changers going into that game. And it's, you know, the fact that they weren't missing, you know, just having Kaoru running at them causing chaos, because I don't think they looked that great at the back. And I think obviously we lost 4-0, and that's going to be the scoreline that everyone's looking at. But we didn't play badly. We didn't actually play that badly. We just did not take our chances. You know, on another day, if a Dingra shot had gone in rather than hitting the post, if Danny Welbeck remembered that he was a striker, it was...
Oh, even 4-2 changes the complexion. But Jason, do you share AD's optimism for Thursday?
No. having said that, and I have just put this on North Stand chat about an hour ago, it's the freest of free hits. So I'm looking forward to the game. I'm going to have a couple of beers and go there and sing my heart out, and who knows. But my gut feeling is that we'll push up on them, desperately try to score, not quite score. And Dybala and Lukaku will go up the other end and score a couple of goals, and everyone will leave at half time.
Yes.
Well, you know, look, this is only the fourth ever home game in the Albion's history in a European tie.
Brilliant. Don't get me wrong. And if we have
wait 123 years for one, and you know,
if we're going to bow out tomorrow, this week, if we're going to bow out, let's do it in style. Let's go in flair. Well, let's lose, you know, 7-4 or something. You know, if we're going to do it, I totally agree with Jason. It is the freest of free hits. That said, you don't want to think that we're going to go kamikaze into it and therefore lose 6-1, but you know, because a 10-1 aggregate scoreline does hurt. I mean, it's the one thing I've said to you though, AD, is that if we win 3-0, and it's possible, it's not impossible, if we win 3-0, I'll be seriously annoyed, because I know we've got two other goals to talk about first, but it's the third one, which incidentally seems to have been completely and utterly swept under the carpet with the vast majority of the media. If, you know, that third one, which was bent, you know, we'd have gone out.
Well, let's get into it now, Al.
Go on. Right. Okay, bent. Right. Let's talk about let's face it, the four pieces of information that we want to talk about for the game are the four goals, because above and beyond that, chances were equal. They took theirs. We didn't take ours.
I could talk about the fact that Jason Steele was preferred to Barbara Brooken, but that's another story.
Well, how many goals would you how much of the 4-0 defeat would you blame squarely on him?
None, exactly. Really, but I mean, I think actually, bizarrely for Jason Steele, his goalkeeping was actually very good in this game, and his distribution wasn't. It's usually the other way around.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think any of the four goals are down to Steele. Three of them were walked in, and one of them was offside, and that's that. But I think De Zerbi said after the game that we all played at 80%, or we played with 20% left on the pitch, or whatever. That included Steele. His passing was abysmal, and he was only in there for his passing.
That is kind of an interesting point. That was what unseated Robert Sanchez in the first place, was the fact that Steele could actually ping a decent pass. And
oh, he still can, but it's just like a lot of our players over the last few weeks, you know, the form hasn't necessarily been there. We've seen a lot of, like, I mean, Purvis Estupiñán, and his form's just fallen off a cliff since he's come back from injury.
Yeah, it has. And I it's not so much pinging a pass for me up. Still can play the patterns De Zerbi wants to play under pressure. He doesn't care that he's got a great big hairy striker and a yard from him. He'll just play it calmly. But his passes were often misplaced, and particularly in the first half.
I'd be of the opinion, and like I say, that whole thing of playing the ball around the back with, like I say, someone charging down, it's rarely failed. I mean, we're now into, what, 75-ish games into De Zerbi's reign here, and we must play that ball around 30 times a game, 20, let's say 20 times a game. That means we're talking 1,500 times they've done that thing where basically they're trying to scare the bejesus out of us. And yeah. And then three passes later, we're over the halfway line motoring towards their goal. And we think, I mean, in that sense, I'm kind of a bit more relaxed about it. And I think the number of times it's gone wrong is, you could count them on one hand, I would say. Certainly those that have then led to a goal. No, actually, those that have gone wrong probably maybe 20 times. Those that have led to a goal maybe 4 or 5 times. And from memory, I think, I don't think any of them, maybe one is from steel. So I know that there's people coming up to me or coming up to us and saying, right, well, these are the stats under Verbruggen and these are the stats under Steele. And that doesn't really necessarily tell the whole story. Yes, he's made X saves. Yes, he's conceded this many goals. Yes, there's this many passes. But OK, who have we been playing against? What was the team like? And as you've pointed out to me, AD, you know, and what's the team like in front of him playing like that day? Are they playing like gladiators or idiots? You know, so I still don't have a problem with Jason Steele. I really don't. In as much as I think that Verbruggen has improved to a given point, Steele has marginally regressed to a given point, to the point that now they are both have the same faults and the same strengths. You know, Steele has been getting better as a goalkeeper, Verbruggen has been getting better at distribution. And on that path, then in theory, you'd think, well, very soon Verbruggen will overtake Steele. I'm sure a lot of people saying he already has. I'm still okay with either of them playing at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, Jason, I mean, this is just an open question, really. I mean, but how are you with us changing the goalkeeper every game?
Not
or every two games?
No, pick one and stick with it. You have one goalkeeper who's going to play your Premier League games and your Europa League games unless he gets injured, and another one who's kind of your second choice who's going to play League Cup and FA Cup for me. And I'd play for Verbruggen. One of our other moderators on North Stand Chat is a guy called Simon Huffer, who's a pretty
nice Simon,
and was a goalkeeper for the Renf team for a long time, and he summed out my fella. So I'm stealing an opinion here, but what he said was, you know, Verbruggen is better at the all round goalkeeper stuff, the saving, the cross, dominating, all of that kind of stuff, and Steele is better with his feet, but Verbruggen is a much better keeper and closer to Steele with his feet than Steele is with the goalkeeping stuff to Verbruggen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so, that's
Verbruggen needs to play to develop as well. It's another young player that we've got in that we might have for a couple of seasons and then flog, you know, if he's successful.
Well, he's already the Dutch number one, isn't he?
Yeah. So, he's the Dutch number one and he's not our number one, and it frustrates the bejesus out of me. I'd much rather we just played him.
All right, so shall we look at these goals then?
If we must.
Well, okay. Well, I had an issue all game with us. I think, generally speaking, it is possibly a De Zerbi trait, possibly. But there is no pressure. There was no pressure on the ball from when the crosses were coming in. So the ball, I mean, at the early doors, there was a ball from Spinazzola, who put it on a plate for Lukaku, and still made a brilliant save, actually. And it was, but this was happening time and time again. It was happening on both sides. I mean, Lamptey was particularly guilty of not pressuring the ball and the ball coming in. And it was just too easy. I mean, Lukaku had a couple of free headers, and no one was stopping the ball coming in. That was a frustration for me.
That was the point you were making, actually. I think at the time you were saying we can stop the crosses if we feel like it. Which I think is the kind of the summation of what you just said there. It's the midfield and not closing down quickly enough. And Lukaku seems to have the run on dunk every single time. Mm. I mean, don't get me wrong, Lukaku looks like he's enjoying himself in Rome. We saw a really dissatisfied donkey playing for the London Cowboys when he played against us before.
And for Man United,
Well, one thing, I remember there was a game 3 years ago, the one where Welbeck equalised in the last seconds. But Lukaku scored for them, and then we just bossed the game. And it was kind of one of those where you could see the tide turn. This was under Potter. And Andy Townsend, because he's a pillock, gave Lukaku the man of the match, even though Brighton were clearly the better side. And then when Welbeck equalised, I mean, Townsend got pelters. But the point is, Lukaku, he was getting no service. He wasn't happy. His shoulders were slumped. His body language is appalling. And yet last Thursday, he looks like he's having a ball. And when he's in that sort of mood, I'm afraid Lewis Dunk doesn't, and probably most defenders across Europe don't stand a chance.
When you give him that much space, though, he's going to have fun. I mean, he was one-on-one with Dunk for the I know we were talking about the first goal, but for the second goal, he was one-on-one with Dunk and brushed him off like a pesky fly. But that's because that three at the back system left us constantly vulnerable to quick breaks.
And it was like the first goal was just a simple ball over the top. I mean, obviously the flag did initially go up for offside. We all thought it was offside at the time, and I'm still trying to work. I mean,
I think it's
someone
saying
it was Lamptey playing him, but I was looking again today and I couldn't quite see it, so it must have been Dunk.
No, I've seen the lines. It is Lamptey, as opposed to the third one, we don't get to see the lines. I've seen the lines, and yeah, it's, and actually you could see it, and you think when you see it without the lines, you saw the ball being played, and Lamptey, you could see what was happening, or he could see what was happening, but he was just half a pace too slow in stepping up. If that ball had been delayed by a second, Lamptey would have been stepping up in time, and yes, your man would have been offside. So yes, I've seen the lines, and as much as I got the ump with it on Twitter at the time, I was called out for it, and yes, it's not the sort of goal that you really, not the kind of goal you want to concede when you're supposed to play your defensive line as a unit, and so if everyone's going to step out, then everyone should step out. But yeah, Lamptey was just that half a pace too slow, and your man was through.
Dybala had a good game, Jay.
He's a fantastic player. He just, again, had a lot of space, but he's quick and he's clinical, and we didn't cope with him in any way. And this is why I mentioned earlier on when we said it's a free hit. If we get broken on quickly by Lukaku and Dybala again here, we will be in trouble because they were quick and clinical.
There it is again, though, Jake. You just used the word twice in that sentence, clinical, and that is just something that we're just not at the moment. And like, I love Danny Welbeck. I absolutely adore Danny Welbeck, but he could have had a hat trick in this game, and probably should have had a hat trick in this game because, I mean,
the keeper made the saves though, didn't they?
Well, that keeper he's been playing for Serbian, isn't he? He's been the Serbian number one from 16 years of age.
So he's got a bit of experience in dealing with centre forwards. So, it's not as though, like say, Welbeck was poor. Far from it. I mean, it's not as though it was poor finishing necessarily. He had as many chances knocked over the bar or saved as Lukaku did. It's just that what Lukaku had was a defender making an absolute dropsy in a one-on-one, whereas Roma didn't do that.
Yeah, Sevilla, that's his name. Mile Sevilla.
Yeah. So it's... you're saying this about Welbeck being clinical. Yes, on another day, he might have actually had, but he did what he needed to do in as much as he got the headers on target. Yeah. And it's not as though he had ever had a free header. I mean, he worked hard for the chances that he made. And sometimes when you are just leaping off balance and what have you, then you just get the header in as best you can. And I thought he was fine. The issue I particularly had in the first half, and it's something that Adam Virgo picked up on commentary. And if we're going to name names, let's name names. Nciso didn't look match fit and wasn't really contributing anything. And Buonanotti just wanted to spend his time on his backside. And again, I think we're back to the whole thing of Buonanotti being out wide. And yes, we understand that he has to be on account of the fact that we're deficient in those areas at the moment. But when he is out wide, he just looks so totally anonymous. And I think there's also it'll come because we can't complain about a 19-year-old. You know, he's never going to be the finished product, but his decision making needs to, or he needs to be encouraged for his decision making to be. It's that extra touch. It's that person he's trying to beat. He's trying to beat the fifth man where actually the pass out wide is on. It's that kind of thing. And if it doesn't happen, Roma, who I thought were probably one of the best sides I've seen us play this season, certainly going forward and certainly in terms of keeping the ball, once we lost the ball, we were not getting it back anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, this is what Nikki Bandini was saying on the show a couple of weeks ago. And she says, you're playing the wrong Roma. The one you want to play the Mourinho Roma rather than the De Rossi Roma, because it's like, oh, he's just like, oh, I've got all these amazing front players. Oh, we can use them. It's incredible what a difference that it's made, because they're just on this absolutely amazing run and scoring goals for fun, and it was always going to be an uphill struggle, and is this a fair criticism that De Zerbi's only got one way of playing? Because I mean, we saw on Sunday that we can take the ball to the corner flag and we can grind it out. But sometimes in these sort of games, particularly in a two-legged affair, you need to keep it tight at the back for the first 20 minutes. You need to be a little bit more dogmatic.
In answer to, as a direct answer to your question, you know, is it fair to say De Zerbi only plays one way? Well, there has never, ever, ever been a game since De Zerbi, certainly since he got here, because obviously we can't comment before he got here, where he's played one way. He's chopped and it's a bit like Potter. He'll change the system and the players will notice, you know, okay, well, we're setting up like this. First 5-10 minutes isn't working. So-and-so goes 10 yards further forward. Someone comes further wide. He is constantly changing the way that we play. Not in terms of the massive difference that we had between the what we call De Zerbi ball and what we saw against Forest. That's something else we'll come on to in a minute. But what I mean is, in order to cope with a player who's bossing the midfield or a player who's doing this or this forward, you know, and very rarely have we ever been outplayed. Probably the exception, maybe Arsenal away, but even then, have we been outplayed for 90 minutes because De Zerbi hasn't been able to tinker the system? No, he plays plan A, B, 3, C, all the way through to G and H every single game.
No, he doesn't, Al, because he plays plans D to Z, but A, B, C don't exist because that's the back.
I'm going to sort of settle somewhere slightly in the middle. What he does do very well, I observed, particularly from up in the West Upper, is we use different formations in and out of possession, particularly. We do what Al said sometimes. So we are going to bring players into gaps when we're creating overloads. We've seen players move from number 10 out wide back to number 10 and back to almost like a right attacking midfielder when we're going forward. That's all fine. But he is a little bit stubborn on things that get caught out. We've talked about the goalkeeper stuff. I don't agree with it. I think we played three at the back for far too long. It wasn't working because that's a system that relies on us completing every single pass perfectly. And as soon as we lost it under pressure, you ping it in behind the wing back. Because there is no wing back.
This is it. It's like the stopping the cross thing, isn't it?
We don't close crosses down. I don't understand why we don't close crosses down. It frustrates the hell out of me. So I think De Zerbi is a very flexible and intelligent coach, but he's also quite stubborn.
And it goes back to the thing that you've been saying for weeks and months and Al, that he's never going to be in line for one of the top jobs this summer because he can't sort the defence out. That's your words.
If he's going to take one of the top jobs, it's going to be Barcelona, Liverpool or Bayern Munich. And, you know, realistically, at least one of those jobs he's not going to get because it's going to go to the guys at Leverkusen at the moment. He's got his pick. So De Zerbi second up to start off with. And it would be interesting to see if he could sort a defence out with a bigger squad of slightly more experienced players. And I say that knowing that, you know, Webster and Dunk are experienced, Veltman is experienced, but Estupiñán's having complete second season syndrome. Lamptey's still only, what, 20, 21. We've really got no depth in defence at all. And so it becomes difficult.
So does this go back to what De Zerbi was saying after the match about, I mean, we know that like Tony doesn't like to do the January window, but he's been uber critical of it all.
I think every manager is. I mean, every manager wants the best squad, and they want the club to spend the money that they do. And, you know, of all clubs that anyone's going to moan about that kind of thing of trying to look after their own pocket, it's going to be Brighton Hove Albion. And to be honest, De Zerbi, you know, he knows this. I mean, he might have this little sort of grump. He'll have this little sort of whine, you know, and the next manager will probably... I mean, Gus Poyet used to say the same as well. Admittedly, that didn't end well. But I think that, you know, I'm not reading too much into that, you know, because they'd have had their discussions behind closed doors as well about De Zerbi will want to say to Paul Barber or to Tony Bloom or to David Weir and say, I want this person, I need this person. And interestingly, reading up on Andy Naylor in The Athletic, where he talks about, you know, is it right that De Zerbi should be so critical of the club? Well, by all means, I think that the club is democratic enough that they'll allow that kind of thing, because at the end of the day, they're all pushing each other hard. You know, that when Paul Barber said, you know, the club's talking about being top 10, and De Zerbi turns around and say, hey, what's wrong with actually pushing for top six then? And I'm going, all right, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. And I think that sometimes, I wouldn't mind betting De Zerbi probably sees something within the club that says, well, there's no reason, even though we're a smaller club, there's no reason why we can't be top six. Whereas there's in my opinion, a more pragmatic view that said, let's do this in baby steps rather than, you know, doing this unsustainably. I don't know if that sort of, you know, comes across to you, Jace.
But for me, that I think there's a little bit of a crossroads. So we talked about, you guys talked about Enciso not being fit, Buonanotte not particularly looking very good. But what they are is very young guys. Lamptey, as I just said, is a very young guy. Mm. So they're coming out into the Stadio Olimpico full of, you know, 70,000 ultra nutters, letting off flares and waving flags and singing Roma, Roma, Roma. And they're going,
oh, they do love a flag.
They do love a flag. And
a homophobic banner as well.
They're playing against players who are seasoned Champions League and Europa League professionals, guys like Dybala, guys like Lukaku, who we've mentioned, keeper who's been playing international football since he was 16. At some point, does Bloom say, this model is fine, this model is working because it's what we need financially, and we're just going to have to keep buying the kids and developing them and moving them on? And when we get older players, there's a risk their legs have gone, like Lallana and Milner. Or do we look for some players that occupy that middle ground and say, lads, this is how it's going to be in the Stadio Olimpico. This is how what we need to do.
Well, look, I mean, just to like, paraphrase you there, I mean, you mentioned a name there, like James Milner. I mean, obviously, he has got turned quite easily this season by certain wingers in certain games, but that old head, that experience in that sort of game is exactly what we need. And not actually, we were quite surprised that Lallana didn't come on at some point on Thursday, because you needed a little bit of nous out there, and it's
we're back to squad management then, aren't we? And because we're deficient, because we're so bereft of the players we need. I mean, if all those players were fit, there's a better chance Lallana would have played, on account of the fact that De Zerbi can then afford to actually save one or two others for the league game. You know, it's a bizarre thing that he has, because he's so bereft of the squad at the moment, that he has to use Lallana that much more sparingly.
Well, you know what? I mean, De Zerbi has been very critical of himself this week as well, saying that he could have managed the squad a little bit better, but it's just very, the fact that we've had so many injuries is kind of like it's not just us. Most clubs have had a lot of similar injuries, all soft tissue injuries. It's been really frustrating for a lot of clubs,
but
particularly for us, because we're obviously, you know, this pioneering season of us in Europe. It's just.
Well, there is that, but I also still say, and I will go back to it, and if De Zerbi heard it, you know, not he's going to listen to me, but if he heard it, you know, he'd be tearing his hair out. But I still think this is, oddly enough, a season of transition. You know, like you say, here we are, first time in Europe. It's a massive learning curve, not just for the players, but for the, clearly for the manager himself, for the club themselves. Everyone is, you know, for the fans as well, especially. I mean, we've all been to four brilliant cities. We've had a great time. We want more. And I'm sure we will get it. We may not get it this season, but that therefore shouldn't necessarily be seen as a failure. I would actually put this down as being our second best season ever. Is that really something worth crying over? Knowing full well, admittedly, the best season was the one before, and therefore have we regressed? But, you know, Basingstoke wasn't built in a day. Rome might have been, but basically, you know, we're still on the trajectory, the path, the direction of travel is still the right way. And so for everyone, we're all being uber critical of ourselves, of each other. And I'm thinking there are times when I just say, look, enjoy the ride. You know, it's not as good as it was last year in terms of stuff on the pitch. But hey, we're establishing ourselves. We're putting the meat and potatoes together. We're putting things together for us to be seen as an established top 10 side. And if that means having to eat a poo sandwich now and again, in order that we can then progress, I'll buy that.
Tony Bloom is going to run this club the way Tony Bloom wants to run it. And no one person within the organisation is bigger than the club, even including Tony. So if he feels that the right way to go is softly, sustainably, continuous improvement, but without overreaching ourselves, that's exactly what we'll do.
And do you think that's the right way?
I did last season. I possibly still do this season. I think we've been very unlucky with injuries. I didn't agree with the recruitment in January. I think we should have brought a couple of people in, even if it was on loan.
But if those people aren't available and or they're out of your price range, then you don't
and
do it.
I think the first thing you said there is probably more true than the second one. It was a dead window. No one was selling. No one was buying.
Yeah,
no, exactly. I mean, and even like Leicester, who are desperate for money, we couldn't do. I mean, obviously, we wanted the stately home, but
Dewsbury Hall. Also, what you get is if you buy in the January window, and then all those players that you're expecting to come back, you've then got surplus to requirements. The fact that we were then completely done over by the fact that okay, Mitoma came back and then crocked himself, and then Hinshelwood we lost, and we're not expecting to lose the kids in the way that we are. It's one of those things. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If we get a couple of loanies or a couple of players in, we end up the season overburdened with players that we can't make use of, versus not getting anyone in and the injury list growing. It's like I say, you're buggered either way.
Yeah, but Joe, I mean, a few months ago, it would have been you would have been astounded for us to say, yeah, we're really going to miss Jack Hinshelwood.
Yeah, where he was, he kind of came in as a fill-in, didn't he? He was kind of like, oh dear, we've got all these injuries. Who can we do? I know, we've got this midfielder in the under-21s. We'll stick him at right back and see how he gets on. And he was brilliant. Now we're missing him.
Yeah.
Well, he had a habit of coming up with crucial goals.
Yeah, I did, and they were all the two of them were exactly the same. Just
yeah.
That timing of the run at the back stick and the little head back across is brilliant.
I mean, if he was playing on Thursday, those balls coming into from Adingra, and particularly and also that ball that was like pinged across the box from Lamptey, which I'm still annoyed that nobody attacked.
Well, let's talk about the one aspect of this game that really did get my craw. I mean, don't get me wrong, Rome were clearly better than us, but it's not helped by the fact that when. As much as we talk about VAR and this crunch, and yes, it is rubbish here, I actually thought it was better in Europe. Evidently not. Czech's badge, perfectly good goal. Now, what we've only ever seen is one line, which is, I think it's the back heel of Van Hecker. Meanwhile, the forward, who, and double whammy here, three of them at the back stick unmarked. Where were you, Igor? But the one who did get the ball, clearly offside. And I'm all for VAR hurrying up and not taking 6 minutes to make a decision. But this one wasn't even close. Have you seen the stills, either of you?
Yeah. I mean, well, I was fortunate enough to be up in the press box watching the game on Thursday, and to a man, everyone was scratching their heads, going, "Well, that does offside. No, that's clearly offside. Oh, look, there he is. He's offside. There's the line. Yeah, no, he's still offside. What, they're giving it?"
Yeah, and the still we've ever seen is only one line rather than the second line.
Yeah.
I mean, notwithstanding the Albion have asked UEFA to investigate the game, I mean, I think they've, as I understand it, again from Andy Naylor, they've asked about the VAR decision. Now, I mean, there's nothing we can do about it, but it is one of those irritating things that if we win 3-0, we'd have lost to a, got knocked out to a bent goal. Now, without wishing to sound like an entitled Chelsea fan, heaven forfend that I should do that. It'll be end up being an untidy way to go out. But having said that, I'm still confident that we're going to get stuffed 6-0 on,
Well,
at
it's not
home
like the
anyway.
Italians to ever do anything bent out.
No, and let's face it, Roma have history have precedent in this regard. But let's not go too far down that line. I don't think the Reverb lawyers will appreciate it.
Indeed. Well, okay, but you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, we brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and we do have a shirt of the week for you. So if you want to have a go at describing this one for me.
You want
Right.
to go? Go
Colours, Shrewsbury Town.
on then.
Sponsor.
No
Maybe
cucumbers were harmed in the making of
American.
this shirt.
Maybe an American, I don't know, mole or like some
Center Prize
enterprise
International.
international. It's like those things, those companies that Bond villains run.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's Millennium Season, I can see, but the badge has been neatly blurred. So I have no idea. Is it non-league? Is it a pub
So you
expat
think it's
club?
English?
It quite possibly English, but if it's English, it's
I yeah, it is English.
Well, I also say that the shirt maker is Van Dannel. Like I say, the Centre Prize International thing, it's either, like I say, one of those international conspiracy things that are going to take over the world, and they always want £100 million return of Princess Chlamydia, or it's a haulage removal firm. But it is basically Shrewsbury Town. I can see Derek Smalls in this. I can't tell who the badge is, but I'm going to say Basingstoke because that's what it looks like.
What is it with you and Basingstoke
It's my
today?
standard unit. It always has been my standard unit of obloquy and horrific towns.
Well, you
It
know
is.
what? This is Basingstoke Town.
Is it really? Is it really?
It really is. It's like when you mentioned it earlier in the show, I knew this was coming up.
Yeah.
But
Well, I listen to our faithful and loyal listener. I am speechless.
anyway, here's your shirt of the week, and it's the 1999 to 2000 home shirt of Southern League Premier Division side Basingstoke Town. They are nicknamed imaginatively the Stoke, and they were formed in 1896 and originally played at the Lord Camrose Stadium until 2019, when the chairman tried to sell off the ground for development, meaning the club was forced to ground share with Winchester. For a season. They return to Basingstoke in 2020, and they play at the 2,000 capacity Winkleberry Sports Complex in the Hampshire town. That chairman, Rathi Razak, is no longer with the club, and good riddance, says Phil. The club has had numerous Isthmian and Southern League honours to its name, and have made it to the second round of the FA Cup on three occasions, most recently in 2006 when they went out to local rivals Aldershot. Notable former players include comedian Russell Howard, who played for the Stoke in the late 90s. Others include Fraser Franks, Angus McDonald, Matt Carmichael, Scott Fitzgerald, who are not all exactly household names, but they've all had relatively decent football league careers. Most notable players, though, that also turn out to be links to the Albion. Left back Graham Pearce played 88 times for Brighton between 82 and 86, and later in his career, he was with Basingstoke for the 92-93 season. Anton Rogers has made fleeting cup appearances for us between 2012 and 2013. He's been at Basingstoke since 2021. Simon Fox joined us from Basingstoke in 94, and he made his league debut at the age of 16 years and 238 days. And another youngster joined us from Basingstoke, forward Phil Andrews. And current third choice goalkeeper Tom McGill played 11 times for Basingstoke on loan in 2019. And there is a one for the future, apparently. Brighton under 21 striker Brody Pitt signed us from Basingstoke in the summer. So there you go. Thanks for that, Phil. Okay, well, let's get into the nuts and the bolts of the Forest game. You were delighted, Jason, to see that we had a change of goalkeeper.
We did. Well, I wasn't delighted to see we had a change of goalkeeper. I was delighted to see we were playing the goalkeeper that I wanted to play.
Yeah, so, but I mean, it was also
the first... And we kept a clean sheet, shall I say.
Yeah. The only one kept a clean sheet, I think, this season, isn't it? Only the first Premier League start in 2 years for Jakub Moda as well.
He very nearly didn't finish the game either.
He very nearly didn't finish the... Well, he didn't finish the game anyway because he got subbed after that. But it was... I think we can all put our hands up and say the officials got that one wrong, can't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was more of a red card than Billy Gilmore's was.
Yep. Actually, I mean, I gave my treatise on that. Jace, what was your take on the Gilmore red card from a couple of weeks ago?
Blimey, I've got to try and remember it now. I didn't think it was a red at full speed, and from certain angles, I didn't think it was a red. And then I think there was a still that someone put on North Stand chat, which might even have been Darren, when it shows the studs going straight into the ankle after the challenge. So, by the letter of the law, it's endangering the player. It is a red card, but it's an amber for me. If it had been given as a yellow, there wouldn't have been too many complaints from them, I don't think.
So what, to you, is the difference between this one and a Modder's lunge?
Well, Modder's lunge is an absolutely nailed on red card that the referee and VAR got wrong.
That's one way of putting it.
He's out of control. He's leading with his stats. It's an awful tackle.
I think the term we're looking for here there was aggressive force. Excessive force, sorry.
Yes. Well, excessive force. He's off the ground, which means that he's not in control. His studs are up. You can see I actually think it's a genuine attempt to get the ball. It's just a really bad one. The fella gets there first. And, you know, they've got to play with the level of due care and attention because even at the time when you could see him going for it, because, I mean, the build-up to that is he just evades someone who's trying to trip him up, gets past someone else, and the ball sort of skids off him. And then you can see it almost in my mind, I see it in slow motion. You're thinking, he's really going for this. You need to get it. And you think, well, if he gets it, it's a brilliant tackle. But if he doesn't, then it's the old Humphrey hook for him, because it wasn't big, it wasn't clever, it was stupid. I think there's barely a Brighton fan that could actually say it wasn't a red card.
I mean, there's not too many tackles where you actually think that the player is honestly trying to injure another player, apart from John McGinn this weekend. That was quite funny.
Almost. Yeah.
Well, and the tackle that Sheffield United put in after 13 minutes on Kyren Matoma. That was horrendous.
It was a bad tackle, but I don't... It wasn't... It was bad.
It was
really bad.
The thing is that he got applauded off, and I think that actually what... Because obviously I sit about six rows, well, probably about 10 rows back from the TV screens, and everyone's standing up when they see that there's a VAR check. And the people around it, you know, the sort of first three or four rows behind the TV screen saying, that's it, he's off, he's done. You know, and, you know, they said, right, check over, yellow card is enough. And everyone was going, for you, TFFT, as they wouldn't say in the stadium. But, really not good, not clever. And I think that any honest football fan, you know, you want to see your team play well, you see them play aggressively, they want to be tenacious, you want to see them get into it, but you don't want to see them dirty. It reflects, oddly enough, it reflects badly on you. As much as we're proud of, we can hold our heads high and say we play some really good football, by the same token, we also don't want to see that we play dirty football.
Okay, I mean, there wasn't an awful lot to take out of this game. Obviously, it was a scrappy own goal, which even Forrest tried to, like, they were arguing
that was hilarious. They claim that there's a foul on the keeper.
Yeah, which was by their own player. But I mean, I think one highlight for me, Al, and they obviously didn't show this in the highlights. So, but there was, I mean, you're going to have to delete this. But there was an impressive 32, 48, 64 pass move. But the move that ended up with on Cizo nearly repeating his goal of the season from last year.
Well, the thing is, I mean, when you say there was not a great deal to, and I'm going to get onto this in a sec, but when you say there wasn't a great deal to take from that, I'm actually going to disagree and say that what it was that we saw for the first time De Zerbi ball where we played and won ugly. And I think it was a, yes, we got the 3 points, which was the important thing, but it was a performance whereby we weren't quite so kamikaze. There was a bit more of a conservative approach to this particular game, you know, where sometimes, especially in the second half, and we've given away so many silly cheap goals in the past, where we're going forward and we're only committing three players forward, where other times, and I'm thinking of the Spurs game most recently, we think, well, instead of saying we have what we have, we hold, we're still going kamikaze for it and we get undone for it. So there was times, like I say, in the last 10, 15 minutes, we commit three players forward, where previously it's six or seven. And like you say, taking it into the corner, that for me, if I was going to give that work, that particular performance a name, I'd say it was Houghton-esque. There was a real sort of sense of the Albion from about 6 or 7 years ago. But the point is that, one, they kept the clean sheet. Two, they got the 3 points. But in the middle of all that, or rather towards the end of all that, I think it was the 87th minute, there was that 30-plus pass move. And each one was as delicate and as properly done as close as you could get, before Enciso completely ruined it by smashing the ball into the back of the stand, with the net nearly getting in the way.
It
would have been goal of the decade, because a goal really not befitting the game.
But Lallana, when he came on as well, I mean, he did calm everything down, and he was magnificent when he came on, I thought.
Oh, there was some great outhousery from Lallana.
Yeah, I mean, he was great. I thought he was absolutely magnificent when he came on. I just thought he was, he was probably responsible for that whole corner flag routine, and he just calmed everything down, but it was good. And just, we should point out that, I know that the Forest boss, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Nuno Santo, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And I know that Nuno got a little, his knickers in a twist after the game about the red card. And yes, it was a wrong decision. But we should also point out that one of their players should have been sent off as well. It was like, I mean, they were taking it in turns to kick people. But was it Omadeli? He could have had about six yellows, to be fair. So it was,
And that's the beating of the butterfly's wings, isn't it? Because then probably Mother doesn't need to make that tackle, and the ball doesn't sort of end up in that area anyway. So,
yeah,
they got two wrong. They got theirs wrong.
Such are the fine margins of football.
Well, that is all we've actually got time for this week. So, thank you to Alan Wes. Thank you to Jason Thackeray. I've been Ady Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. We'll see you all again next week.